Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 1300 hours GMT on the 16th of August, these are our main stories. A BBC investigation has been told by Ukrainian prisoners of war about their ill treatment while they were held in Russia. The Vietnamese electric car startup company VinFast is now worth almost twice as much as Ford or General Motors after making its US stock market debut. And at the Women's World Cup in Australia,
these are very, very, very happy fans seeing England make history to the finals as they face Spain.
Up to 10,000 Ukrainian soldiers are believed to be in Russian captivity. Now, some who've been released in prisoner exchanges have told the BBC that they were subjected to torture, including frequent beatings and electric shocks. A dozen former prisoners of war describe a pattern of extreme violence at the pre-trial detention facility number 2 in Taganrog in southwestern Russia. Such ill treatment would be a clear violation of international humanitarian law. The UN says Russia has not allowed its human rights monitors to visit the places where Ukrainian captives are being held. Our correspondent Hugo Bashega tracked down some of those who were held in Taganrog to hear their stories.
Artem was a sniper with the Azov regiment in Mariupol. Last year, in May, the city was under a Russian siege. He wanted to keep on fighting, but Ukraine ordered its troops in the Azovstal steelworks to surrender.
When I heard about captivity for the first time, I had the worst images in my head about what could happen.
Artem was eventually taken to a detention center in the Russian city of Taganrog, a two-hour drive from Mariupol. He was held there for 7 months. He says he was frequently beaten and given electric shocks. He often witnessed other captives suffering too.
After the beatings one day, I was brought to a room.
I saw a young man holding his hands up. His fingers were bleeding.
Did they insert needles under your fingernails? I asked. He said yes.
I spent weeks tracking down Ukrainians who had been taken to Taganrog and returned. People like Irina, who is now a conscript officer in the military. She was a combat medic when she surrendered. She says not even the women were spared the brutality of the guards.
Sheer hell. The scariest part was when they called you up for interrogation. They dragged us by our hair. They beat us in the kidneys, in the ribs, with hammers and batons.
How do you describe Taganrog?
Only devils live and work there.
In western Ukraine, I tracked down Denis, a military surgeon, who's just finished a night shift at a public hospital. He tells me captives were beaten as soon as they arrived in the prison, in rooms, hallways, and even in the shower. He was left with 3 broken ribs and could barely breathe.
They threw me on the floor, ordered me to not lift my head up, and gave me electric shocks until they discharged the entire taser battery on me. You are convulsing. If you lift your head off the floor, they start beating you, and the circle never ends.
Ukraine says 9 in every 10 prisoners who've been returned allege they were tortured. Dmytro Lubinets is the Ukrainian ombudsman for human rights.
This is the biggest challenge for me now, how to protect our people on the Russian side. And I don't know how, and nobody knows how we can do it.
The Russian Defense Ministry hasn't replied to our requests for comment. But prisoner swaps like this one give hope to families still waiting to see their loved ones again. Back with Artem, we watch a video of his release.
How do you recover from all of this?
I'm currently undergoing treatment, and my priority is to take care of my health so I can put on my uniform, pick up my weapons, and defend my country.
This investigation is supported by testimony from a dozen former detainees of the facility in Taganrog. All of them describe widespread physical and psychological torture. It wasn't something that was being done by some guards. They say it was routine. One former captive even told me a cellmate had died as a result of the violence. For those who are back in Ukraine, there's a long journey towards recovery. But those who are still in captivity may be suffering similar abuse without knowing when or if they'll finally be freed.
Hugo Bacheka. A merchant ship has left the Ukrainian port of Odessa after being trapped there since Russia's full-scale invasion. Kyiv has announced a humanitarian corridor in the Black Sea after Russia pulled out of a deal last month which had allowed Ukraine to export grain. But Moscow has given no assurances it will allow safe passage. James Waterhouse has more.
There are quarters of the insurance and shipping industries which are concerned about how safe this proposed route is. Even Kyiv, its architect, has acknowledged the risks posed by both sea mines and the Russian Navy itself. Nevertheless, the Hong Kong-flagged Joseph Schultz container ship made her way out this morning with more than 30,000 tons of cargo on board. Given how, just 3 days ago, a Russian warship fired warning shots at a vessel before boarding it for an inspection, there are little to no guarantees the Joseph Schultz will make it through the Black Sea without incident. Moscow is also continuing to hit Ukrainian ports with drone strikes.
James Waterhouse. The Vietnamese electrical car company VinFast has made a spectacular debut on its first day of trading and is now valued higher than Ford and General Motors. That makes the founder of VinFast, already the wealthiest man in Vietnam, the fifth richest in Asia. Our correspondent in Singapore, Katie Silver, told me more.
It's had such an amazing debut on the New York Stock Exchange, but for many, people haven't heard of it before. So it's called VinFast. It's headquartered in Vietnam, and it has been one of the electric vehicle makers in the Southeast Asian country that people have been watching. It's owned by the biggest conglomerate in Vietnam, so it therefore has sort of deep investment pockets behind it. And in fact, its founder and chairman made about $39 billion yesterday, given this listing and how well it did in its listing. So it listed by what's known as a special purpose acquisition company, or a SPAC, and many people have been very bullish about what Vietnam's electric vehicle industry could bring, because it's a low cost, it has advanced manufacturing, and it doesn't have those geopolitical risks that you see with something like China, which has been providing a great deal of competition to the United States. And so people have been very bullish about what Vietnam might do in this space.
It is extraordinary, though, isn't it? Because VinFast is now valued far higher than Ford and GM Motors after just its first day of trading. Why is that?
That's right. And to give your listeners an idea of the figures, the way it did, it went up 255%, huge debut. And in fact, now it's valued at $85 billion. That's its stock market valuation. That's much higher than Ford, which is about $48 billion, and General Motors, which is about $46 billion. In part, there was very slim trade. So there's only about $185 million worth of trading. And in part, that is because its chairman and founder, according to regulatory findings, owned about 99% of the shares at the start of the day. And so because there are that slim sort of trading that I mentioned, we can see these big swings and this very volatile market reaction.
And yet this firm has never made a profit.
That's right. And so to give you an idea, in the first 6 months of this year, it actually made a loss of more than $500 million. And its revenue, in fact, slipped. But this is because, as I say, getting into the electric vehicle making space is very expensive. As you can imagine, it costs a lot to develop one of these cars. And so it does require deep pockets in order to be able to fund it and to see it through to fruition.
Katie Silver. Protesters in Pakistan have set fire to a church and attacked the homes of Christians in Punjab province. Police said a few thousand angry demonstrators had taken to the streets in Jaranwala district. Umar Draz Nangiana from the Urdu service in Pakistan told me more.
What we know so far is that police responded to calls of violent protest in the city called Jallianwala, which is located in the Punjab province of Pakistan. And they said that the protesters there were attacking the church buildings in a neighborhood which is housed by the minority Christian community. And when the police launched the initial probe, they came to know that there were certain posts on the social media circulating in the area, after which certain people from the local mosques, they made announcements asking the majority community people to, you know, come out on streets and protest against what they called was the alleged desecration of pages of Quran. It was done by two men from the minority Christian community, according to these people. So the police tried to calm down the situation initially. The local superintendent of the police tried to talk to the protesters and ask them to, you know, not resort to this violent activities. But it was very difficult for the police to control the mob, which was very charged at that point in time. And then when the time passed by, we got the news that, you know, a charged mob was attacking church buildings in multiple locations. So far, the local residents are saying that in that particular community, at least three church buildings have been torched by the mob, and the police are still trying to, you know, control the situation. And many people from that particular area have said to evacuated in for fears of spillover of violence in that particular area.
And what are the authorities doing? Are they just leaving it to local police?
Yes. For now, the local police are trying to control the situation. And at the moment, what they're trying to do is to, you know, control the violence so that it does not spill over to other neighborhoods in that particular city, in that particular town. And what they've done is they've lodged a formal complaint against the two men who were accused of desecrating the pages of Quran. They've still not been arrested, but the police are saying they're trying to assure the majority community people there that, you know, these two men will be arrested and will be tried in the court. And so far, what police are trying to do is, you know, calm down the situation and to protect the installations of the minority Christian community in that neighbourhood.
Umar Drasnangiana from the BBC's Urdu service. The battle for the place in the final against Spain in the Women's Football World Cup has been won by England's Lionesses, who beat Australia's Matildas by 3-1. The match was packed with drama and played in front of a home crowd that filled Stadium Australia in Sydney, from where Shaima Khalil joined us just after the final whistle.
Look, I think it's heartbreak for the hosts. There's been so much build-up in this country, and I'm sure, obviously, in the UK as well, so many people watching this. Millions and millions of Australians were hoping that the Matildas would go into the finals. But I am standing with two England fans with big smiles. Can you just tell us your names?
My name's Tara.
Hi. Killian.
How do you guys feel?
Fantastic. Elated. Delighted.
You were totally outnumbered here, weren't you?
100%. I'm ecstatic.
totally outnumbered. There was literally, I can't believe how few England fans were here, to be honest.
I couldn't spot you. No. I was trying to spot England fans and I could not spot you the whole game. And then they win and you guys spring up.
We made ourselves heard. Let's put it that way.
I'm ecstatic. Come on, England!
You told me before we came on air that you predicted this. What are your predictions for Spain now?
3-0 England.
3-0 England?
I think that's brave. I'm not going to say it. I'm going to say 1-0 England.
There you go. So these are the predictions. I'm telling you, I was worried that I wouldn't find any England fans in the fan zone today because it was just a sea of green and gold. But I can see now red and white. I can see the England flag. I can see England beanies and scarves. It's not going to be as big of a party as it would have been if Australia had won. But these are very, very, very happy fans seeing England make history to the finals as they face Spain.
Well, I suspect, Shaima, people will be scouring the booking for airlines and there might be many more people flying over to Australia hoping to get there for Sunday. But do you think that actually football is the winner in all this because of the legacy this World Cup will leave in Australia?
100%. I think you've nailed it because I was speaking to former Matildas and I was speaking to former players who say, look, this has become much more than just the teams. I think the tournament has become the catalyst and the testament to how far the women's game has come, to how far it can go. I was speaking to some former players who say, look, we're going to have meetings about investment, about sponsorship, about what we can do to build this from the grassroots here in Australia. And I can tell you safely that football, or soccer as they call it here, has been added to the list of sports that Australian fans will follow quite religiously. I could not believe my eyes when they stopped the rugby the other day when Australia was playing France to watch that penalty shootout. Something has shifted in the women's game, and it has done so with the momentum of this Women's World Cup.
Shaima Khalil in Sydney. Still to come here on the Global News Podcast.
This guy's a Russian. Are you okay with a Russian coming up here?
The US band The Killers apologize after inviting a Russian on stage during a show in Georgia.
Wow, what an experience to be a part of the Tokyo Olympics.
It's so etched in my memory.
It's one of the pinnacles of my athletic career.
On the Podium is the podcast where Olympic and Paralympic athletes share their remarkable stories. From the struggles,
lots of sacrifices, lots of hard work, tears, a lot of things that the outside world doesn't know,
to the victories.
In the water, I could do anything that anybody else could do.
On the Podium from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back. North Korea says the American soldier who crossed into the country from South Korea last month had wanted to seek refuge. In Pyongyang's first comments on Travis King, state media said he'd harbored ill feeling towards the U.S. Army. From Seoul, in South Korea, Jean McKenzie told me more.
So this is the first time that the North Koreans have publicly acknowledged that they have Travis King in their custody since he disappeared nearly a month ago now. Now, they say in this statement today that they have spoken to the soldier and that he has told them that he was being inhumanely treated in the US Army and that he was being racially discriminated against. And that also he had become generally more disillusioned with inequality in America. And it was these reasons that led him to run into North Korea that day last month, and that he wanted to seek asylum either there or in a third country. Now, of course, this is just what the North Koreans are telling us that Travis King has said. We don't have any way to verify it. We haven't seen from the soldier. We haven't heard directly from him since he disappeared. Washington today have said that they can't verify these alleged comments and that they're still trying to work hard to negotiate his safe release. But it is worth, I think, noting the background to this peculiar case, which is that Travis King had been in trouble with the authorities here in Seoul, where he was serving on a US tour of duty. And he was due to be flown home, where he was going to be disciplined by the military, perhaps even discharged. And it was this, we think, that led him to make that decision to run into North Korea.
Do we know where he is now or how he is?
So the statement didn't give any of those details. I think the details that we all want to know, where is Travis King? Is he safe? What condition is he in? We still don't know. And crucially, it didn't also give us any information about how the North Koreans are going to treat this soldier going forward. Now, they did say that Travis King had admitted that he'd illegally crossed into the country. So essentially, he's admitted to the North Koreans he's broken the law. Now, what that might mean is they might choose now to treat him as a criminal. He might be prosecuted. But they also might decide to treat him as a victim of, you know, US mistreatment, ill-treatment, and treat him as an asylum seeker.
And could he perhaps be exchanged for someone else?
It's very possible that the North Koreans will use Travis King as a bargaining chip in bigger negotiations. One option is that they will use him further down the line when negotiating with the United States when it comes to their nuclear weapons program, negotiations that have been stalled for many, many years now. But as it currently stands, North Korea hasn't shown much willing or wanting to talk to the United States.
Jean McKenzie. Now to a story that's grabbed people's attention in the last couple of days and brought the term conservatorship back into the news headlines. The retired American football star Michael Oher, whose rags-to-riches tale was adapted into an Oscar-winning Hollywood film, The Blind Side, is suing the family who had him placed under a guardianship order from the age of 18. Mr. Oher, an African-American who's now 37 years old, claims in his court filing that he was never adopted, as he'd believed, by the white family who he lived with and was instead tricked into a conservatorship. The legal definition and function of a conservatorship was highlighted by the case of the US pop star Britney Spears, who legally asked to be released from one granted to her father. The BBC's Victoria Uwankunda has been speaking to Lisa McCarley, a probate and conservatorship lawyer in California, who was prominent during Britney Spears' legal battle.
There are many different ways. It can be that a doctor makes a referral. We use a doctor referral to establish a conservatorship for a person suffering from mental illness. But in Brittany's case, they used a probate conservatorship. Her parents, her father in particular, would have to petition the court, and a judge is supposed to review evidence of inability to take care of oneself or inability to resist fraud or undue influence. So it can be a doctor in some circumstances that makes a referral, or most of the time it's a family member. And in Michael's case, the Tui family apparently petitioned to be his conservator.
And usually under these circumstances, you appoint, as you said, a family member or a parent or a legal guardian. And sometimes, most of the time, they're to oversee personal and financial or financial affairs. Can these guardianships really strip an individual, in the case of Britney Spears or Michael Oher and so many other Americans who are under these conservatorships, of their agency and decision-making rights?
Yes. So basically, that is one of the main reasons why conservatorship should only be established as a last resort, when you're not able to use any other method. And in Britney's case, the reason they were able to get a conservatorship is because the court itself did not follow protocol. In Michael Oher's case, I actually went to the Tennessee file, and what was interesting is that he appeared not only to attend the hearing, but the judge made a finding that Michael consented to the conservatorship and that his biological parents were also notified and consented to the conservatorship.
And so what does that then mean for Michael Oher if he attended the hearing and he was in court when a judge did sign over his conservatorship to the Tuis?
Right. Well, unless the Tuis took further action, the conservatorship appears to have been, as I said, largely abandoned. Had they pursued it, of course, they would have had the right to control his contracts, how much money he made in his pocket, how much money he was paid. They would have had all of those rights. But even within the four corners of the petition or the lawsuit that he files, he acknowledges that he may have gone on to sign the contracts himself with the developers of the movie, The Blind Side, as well as his NFL contracts. In practical terms, it appears to me that it really did not have any impact on his agency or ability to negotiate. There may be other disappointing aspects of the case, in the sense that he may have really thought this made him a member of the family, and it didn't. But whether or not the Tuis ever exerted any power over him or signed any contracts on his behalf, I don't think they would have been legally able to do that.
Lisa McCarley, lawyer and legal expert, speaking from California to Victoria Uwankunda. A form of gene therapy that's already been trialled in patients with Parkinson's disease might provide a potential one-off treatment for severe alcohol addiction. The possible impact on alcoholism is being tested on monkeys. Researchers found that implanting a modified virus in the brains of the animals reduced any strong desire to consume regular amounts of alcohol. The study opens up possibilities for future use of the technique in humans with extreme alcohol dependency. James Copnell has been speaking to Professor Kathleen Grant of the Health and Science University in the US, who co-led the research.
We based this study on a large background of research
that had implicated low dopaminergic tone in, that's levels, in motivational areas in the brain that are related to excessive drinking. So small amounts of drinking will increase dopamine in these motivational areas, but chronic long-term drinking actually decreases and may very long-term decrease this receptor system called dopamine, which is sometimes called a reward system. So we targeted to that system to increase dopamine, hoping we would reverse this chronic heavy drinking.
And so far, the early results are promising.
Yes, it was a very, very strong outcome in this study. These monkeys were, you know, introduced to alcohol. In particular, we've been studying this model for a while, so we know if we start late adolescent, young adult male monkeys, rhesus monkeys, they'll drink pretty heavily, on average about 8 to 10 drinks a day. So what we wanted to do was see if we took alcohol away from them, would they go back to drinking? And we know that they do. So we divided the group into two, and one group got this gene therapy and the other group remained without the gene enhancement. And yeah, we saw that it would block the relapse drinking. It was effective. It became more effective over time, and it was over a 1-year study.
So what's going on in the brain then of these monkeys?
What we did was we put down, surgically, put this gene into a deep brain area. So it's invasive. There's a surgery involved, brain surgery. We lower a needle down and we put the gene into this brain area. And then it becomes active. It gets taken up by the cell, incorporated into the genome, and starts producing GDNF. That's the gene product. It's a growth factor, and it enhances dopamine release up in these motivational areas. So what we're trying to do is counteract the chronic low dopamine related to the desire to drink in people who are addicted to alcohol. So we're trying to counter that by increasing the dopamine in this motivational area.
Presumably, the idea is that at some point this could be useful for humans. How many steps away are we from that being a realistic possibility?
It's in the realm of being a realistic possibility because there's studies going on with this same gene being delivered to humans that are suffering from Parkinson's. And Parkinson's is another disorder related to low dopamine, but more in the motor areas of the brain than the motivational areas. And so because this surgery has been approved and putting this gene down into human brain is in clinical trial right now, it's possible this could be translated into a therapy for the most extreme alcoholics, those that have not responded to conventional therapy.
Professor Kathleen Grant at the National Primate Research Centre at Oregon, speaking to James Copnell. Scientists in California have managed to reconstruct the Pink Floyd song, Another Brick in the Wall, by analysing the brainwaves of patients who were listening to it. The experiment could eventually help people with neurological conditions which impair their speech to communicate more naturally. Joanne Wood has been listening to the results.
This is what the patients, who all underwent surgery for epilepsy a decade ago, heard as they were operated on. A series of electrodes recorded their brain waves, and now the results have been analysed by powerful AI algorithms. And this is what was detected. It is muffled, but you can just about make out the lyrics. The research was carried out by scientists at the University of California, Berkeley, who hoped their work could eventually help restore the natural lyrical pattern of speech to people who've had strokes or have neurodegenerative conditions. The team said that with more sensitive electrodes, the results should improve and could be incorporated into implants. Asked why they chose the Pink Floyd classic, the scientists said it was just a song that they liked.
Joe Inwood. The US rock band The Killers have apologized after the lead singer Brandon Flowers told fans in Georgia, the former Soviet state, that a Russian man he invited on stage was their brother. Georgia is still partly occupied by Russia after it invaded in 2008, and there's been a surge of anti-Russian sentiment in the country following President Putin's decision to invade Ukraine. Stephanie Prentice reports.
This guy's a Russian. Are you okay with a Russian coming out there?
Brandon Flowers, the lead singer of The Killers, was left looking around at the packed arena in Georgia as fans began booing and leaving their seats. The gig at the Black Sea Arena, down the coast from a region occupied by Russian forces, had been going well. But towards the end, the band decided to bring a Russian drummer on stage to join them for their 2006 song, For Reasons Unknown, telling fans that the man was their brother. Georgia gained independence from Soviet rule in 1991, and in 2008, Russia invaded. It currently holds 20% of the land there, and since the war in Ukraine started, many Russians have fled across the border, increasing tensions. In a statement, the band said they hadn't intended to offend anyone, saying it's a tradition of theirs to invite people on stage to play the drums, and adding that their words about all fans being brothers and sisters could have been misconstrued. Fans outside seemed to disagree on the clarity of the message, gathering on the steps and booing at the stadium, with others responding to the statement online saying the apology should have included mention of Russian war crimes and support of Georgia and Ukraine's territorial integrity.
Stephanie Prentice. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Javed Galani. The producer was Lipika Pelham. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.